Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest this morning is New York Times and USA Today best-selling author Cheryl Woods. She has written more than 100 romance and mystery novels. Cheryl and I will be discussing about her life's journey and her special edition novel, A Chesapeake Shores Christmas. Good morning, Cheryl. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great, Johnny. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. I really enjoyed reading your book. It is a wonderful book. It had just the right amount of drama to enhance the flavor in the O'Brien's family. It's just wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you so much. They're a crazy family. I have a lot of fun with them.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I've lived a long time, so I don't know how much we can summarize it in a very short period of time. But
we have the whole hour for you.
that's still pretty quick for however many years I've been around. But I think the main turning points, and one of the things I talk about quite a lot, is that I started out in journalism, and I went to Ohio State with a degree in journalism and worked in journalism for a number of years, and left that field and went into working for a medical center at the same time that I was trying to do some writing. And then when my writing began to succeed, I actually changed directions yet again. And I think one of the things that we all are familiar with are those turning points in our lives. And for me, the big turning point, I mean, I would probably still be a journalist today, except I got mad at my boss one day and said, this isn't fun. It's not fun anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I think everybody has had a day like that where they've, you know, walked out, and hopefully they're not always as impulsive as I was. I turned around and went in the next day and said, you know, I'm done. I'm finished. And I think what that's done for me in my life is to give me a self-confidence that you can reinvent yourself, and that whatever you start out your journey heading towards, it may take a totally unexpected turn. And It's been really wonderful for me, and to discover that I have these different facets, and the fact that I never in a million years expected to be doing what I'm doing now, much less to have 100 and some books behind me.
That's a wonderful story. What kind of books do you read when you were growing up?
You know, when I was little, my mom was a great reader, and from a very early age, she taught me to love books. And I remember, I think the very first book I can really remember was a little picture book. And it turned one side, it had a story about a kitty cat, and on the other side, it had a story about a dog. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea what the book was, but that was what my first memory, and I had that book for a very long time. And then I read all the children's classics, Little Women, Little Prince, just a ton of those kinds of books. And my mom read me all of the Little House on the Prairie books. And it was interesting because I love those Laura Ingalls Wilder books. I just absolutely love them. And later as a TV critic, Little House on the Prairie was on TV. And so I was actually able then to come full circle and, you know, spend time with Michael Landon when that show was on the air and he was starring in it and developing it and that kind of thing. And so that was really kind of a wonderful circle for me to be able to complete in my life.
Were there anyone else in the family that basically enjoyed writing that you kind of picked up along the way?
Well,
habits, so to speak?
Well, my mom really was. I mean, she was both a reader, and she, I think, would have loved to have been a writer. And, in fact, when I was in school, I loved to tell the story. Just a few years ago, I actually discovered a report card from second grade, and my teacher had given me satisfactory and whatever the different grades were, but everything was very good except for one thing, and I was unsatisfactory in creating stories. And I like to think that I've succeeded because I'm very perverse.
Yes.
And the teacher told me I had no imagination now, and now I have 100 and some books I could go show her, if I could remember who she was. I could go show her and say, yes, I can.
There you go. I mean, it's amazing. Wow. That's amazing.
You know, and the thing of it is, my mom unfortunately didn't live to see me write my first book. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, I like to think that she knows that I'm doing this. And I teased one of her best friends several years ago, was looking for one of my books in a store and going along, and the clerk was looking and they were trying to figure out where it was. And all of a sudden, a book fell off the shelves, mm-hmm. and it turned out it was mine. And when this friend told me that story, I looked at her mm-hmm. and I said, mm-hmm. that was my mama.
Wow. There you go. I mean, it's very true. You never know.
Yeah, that's
you
right.
never know.
That's right.
When did you actually discover you like and enjoy storytelling? Because there's a big difference, as you had mentioned, that you enjoy reading. And then, of course, then supposedly you've been labeled as this person or this child that lacks the creativity of storytelling.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I suppose that even though writing, even as a journalist, writing was not the side of journalism I intended to go into. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I ever thought about writing at all, but I did like the storytelling. I mean, as a kid, mm-hmm. I had, you know, all these fantasy things, and I would make up stories in my mind in a way that I think ultimately led me to this. And I think it's an interesting distinction between being a storyteller mm-hmm. and being a writer, because when I sit down to write a book, I want to tell a good story. I want to write about characters that I really love. And the craft of writing, I mean, I'm often asked to try to give classes in writing and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really understand the craft, per se.
Mm-hmm.
What I understand is those characters and getting people captivated with their lives. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing. And I think there's a difference. And I think, I don't know whether all writers approach books in two different ways. I think that there are a lot of people who have a more literary bent mm-hmm. than I do,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, craft each word and the sentences
right.
and those kinds of things. I just sit down and want to get that story on paper. And a number of years ago, a friend of mine called me up one day and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm waiting for my characters to start talking to me." And he just laughed and he says, "Please don't tell that to a mental health professional."
There you go.
But it's true. I mean, I know every writer has experienced this at one point or another, where at some point in a story, and sooner is better than later,
right.
the characters are chatting in your head. No matter, you know, you're
right.
driving down the street and there's this conversation going on in your head.
When you do that, do you find yourself creating all this fantasy and living in it, either as one of the characters predominantly, or perhaps a little bit in every one of them?
I think probably a little bit in every one of them. I mean, people have asked me whether I'm in my books in some way or another.
Right,
and
right.
I do think, you know, they say that good writing comes out of life experiences. And I certainly, like, I haven't killed anybody. I wrote some mysteries and I haven't killed anybody, thank goodness. But oh, there have been a few on my list. But so far I've managed to stay on the right side of the law. But mm-hmm. I do think that there are little elements of me. And in certain books, there are big elements of me.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking a little bit about turning points before. And
yeah.
for instance, I did a book with a suicide theme. And
mm-hmm.
I'd lost two friends, very close friends, to suicide. Mm-hmm. And it was a very personal book for me. And very difficult for me to write, because all of the emotions that I had gone through ended up in that book. So, you know, to one extent or another, there's a little piece of me in all different characters and in the different storylines and so on.
Let's talk about your first book. What's the title of it, and how did you go about writing the first book?
The very first book I wrote was a book called Sandcastles, and I had just quit my job as a journalist, and at that point, this was in the late 1979, 1980, when the romance market was just taking off. There was Harlequin, there was Silhouette, and all the publishers were starting to look to create these category romance lines. And I read a lot of them. I mean, I read mm-hmm. a ton of Silhouettes and Harlequins at the time. And so when I left my job, I looked at a variety of things I thought I might want to try, and I had enough money in the bank to last a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I'm going to see if I can do that because it's what I love to read. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote Sandcastles, and it was a very traditional kind of a romance. I mean, it was what would be referred to now as a sweet romance as opposed to a particularly sexy kind of a romance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I sort of, like, experimented with it. And then, I mean, I had no networking then. I didn't know other people who were doing this. And there was no, mm-hmm. not even a Romance Writers of America organization at the time. It was just mm-hmm. really taken off. And through a variety of contacts, I sent the book off. And I sent it off to somebody at Bantam. And mm-hmm. they had a line at the time called Circle of Love. Mm-hmm. And the person I sent it off to, who was a mutual, we had a mutual friend, and I didn't know who she was at Bantam. For all I knew, she could have been sweeping floors. Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out she was an executive editor of some kind or another, and mm-hmm. or managing editor or something. Anyway, she had an actually fairly responsible position. Mm-hmm. And if I'd known that, I would have been terribly intimidated. But I actually had written a very funny query letter because of this mutual mm-hmm. friend and what we had mm-hmm. in common. Mm-hmm. And I think for that reason alone, they agreed to look at the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they ultimately did buy that book.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, I had started on another book, and I sent that off to Dell.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the first call I got was from Bantam. And they bought the book I'd sent and wanted to know if there was anything else. And I said, well, I have another completed manuscript that's over at Dell.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you know, the status of it. And they said, well, could you mm-hmm. find out? And what about anything else? Well, if you're a smart writer, you always have other things. And mm-hmm. I said, well, and I have a bunch of other ideas. And they said, well, send right. us whatever you have. Well, in a period of something like 6 weeks, I sold 5 books.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It was astounding. Yeah. I mean, it was astounding. Yeah. This was not the starving artist in the attic that I had. I mean, not that they were paying me very much money. I mean, there yeah. was not a lot of money involved. But it was at that stage. And, you know, I was sort of flabbergasted that I was doing it. And in the meantime, I'd actually gone out and gotten a job. That
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I actually stayed in that job for a number of years before I actually believed that maybe I could really do this full time. And took the leap of faith.
Now, you also wrote under pseudonyms the first few books that you wrote. So
exactly,
is there a reason behind that, because you're dealing with so many publishers at the same time?
Well, that was part of it. And at the time, I had just come out of journalism, and a friend of mine, and a fellow journalist, mm-hmm. who was, you know, he would read what I was writing and so on, and couldn't quite get over it because he just didn't totally comprehend that there was a market for this. And he said to me, he says, I don't think you ought to use your real name. You might want to go back to being legitimate again.
Right.
And
that's a good way of putting it.
You know, little did he know. So at any rate, so between that and the fact that two different publishers wanted, you know, if I was going to use the pseudonym, I couldn't use the same one in both places.
Right.
So I ended up with two, and then actually I went with an agent not too long after those two deals were done, and she encouraged me to start using my real name, and we left those two pseudonyms in the dust.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they're long gone. Poor Alexandra and Suzanne are kind of quiet.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
How has your background in journalism helped you in your writings?
Well, I think that the big thing about journalism is that it taught me three things that I mm-hmm. that I constantly refer back to. One is to adhere to deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
Newspapers were going to come out at a particular time, and whatever you had finished at that time was what was going to be there. And so the responsibility, if I make a contract for a deadline, unless we agree for one reason or another to change it, I am very good about trying to meet them. And the other thing it taught me was the ability, when that deadline comes along, to let go. That, you know, I am writing, each time I write, the mm-hmm. very best book I can possibly write at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
then I say goodbye, and it goes out, and I read this with another author, and I honestly can't remember now who it was, but a much bigger name than mine, mm-hmm. who believes that once you finish with a book, it goes out into the universe, and then it belongs to the universe. It's mm-hmm. their interpretation of that book. It's no longer what you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I was actually sort of able to do that all along, is to just let it go and not be panicking over every, I mean, that's not to say I don't panic over every little detail from the commas and the and the back cover copy and the cover art and all, I panic over all of it. But but in terms of the actual writing, I'm able to pretty much let that go. And once it's revised and edited and so on, it's finished. And then the third thing that I think journalism was extremely helpful is that because I was doing so many interviews, my ear was trained to listen to dialogue and the way people talked. And I think, and I think that makes it, if you pay attention in my books, most of what really moves the story along is my dialogue. I don't spend a lot of time on deep description. And, you know, occasionally I have these battles with my editors over that because, you know, they would like me to describe particularly the human beings a little more in detail, you know, and I say my cop-out, which I actually do believe, is that people like to put their own characteristics on these people.
Right.
And you describe them in other ways, but you don't necessarily have to limit yourself to the hair color or the, you know, I mean, I try to put some of that in there, but my real strength is capturing the flavor of them in their dialogue. And I do think that that comes out of journalism. I spent a lot of time doing very long interviews, listening to people, and, you know, we didn't always use tape recorders even back when I started out in journalism. You took notes. And so you had to pay attention to be able to fill in the gaps. And I was very fortunate to have, you know, a number of people come back to me later and say, you got it exactly right. And they just couldn't believe it because we would have talked for a very long time. And they couldn't quite get over the accuracy of that. So I think that's training your ear to hear and listen to things.
When you read a book, you are in tune to the conversations that is in the book. And that's the very essence. That's the message in all actuality. The rest are basically background.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. And I mean, that's what lets you inside of somebody, is what they're saying and what the conversation's all about.
Right.
And I think that that is very revealing, and that's where the sense of humor shows through, and all the, you know, the personality shows through, and whether they're witty or whether they're stuffy or whatever.
Well, do you have a mentor all this time while you were pursuing this wonderful career in writing?
Well, I think probably, you know, initially I was winging it early on, and then when I went with my agent, Denise Marcel, she has been right there from the time she agreed to take me on, and initially she didn't. I mean, I had to, like, hang in there because she wasn't taking on new clients at the time. And one of her assistants, who was actually leaving, and kept saying to her, you have to take this person on, you have to take this person on. And she has been in my corner, even on my, I mean, she is constantly pulling me back from the edge of the balcony and saying, no, you know, this is fine, this is going to be okay. And everything, and she has been, she's got really good business sense, and, you know, I tend to react to certain things very emotionally, and she's got that ability to take the bit, to look at the big picture, and to, she really knows the industry, and we have, over the, I mean, she's the only agent I've had, and in 20-some years that we've worked together, I mean, we have really good career planning goals and conversations and everything. I do think she's made a huge difference in not only my career, but in keeping me sane.
When you mentioned that, what came to mind to me is in the early 80s, if I'm not mistaken, there's a movie titled Romancing the Stone. Kathleen Turner played the writer, obviously, with Michael Douglas, and her relationship with her editor, I guess her agent. And it just reminded me on how emotional, how you get into your writings and everything else. Fascinating story.
No, that was a lot. I think for a lot of us who were working as romance writers, that was that. Of course, we never get Michael Douglas necessarily. I'm sad to say he's not lurking on my balcony as we speak.
It just sort of came to mind as you were talking about the relationship that you went through with your agent. Coming back to you, many of your novels focused on friendship. However, Chesapeake Shores novels are more about family, in particular, of course, the O'Brien family.
Right.
How has writing this sort of a book different? Can you tell us the difference between writing friends versus family-centered books?
Well, I think they're two different things, and I think maybe they come out of who I am and where I am in my life, in that, you know, I was an only child. I grew up without siblings, and so I always envied the idea, and this goes back even to my Little House on the Prairie things, I always envied the idea of a large family. And when I write a lot of novels, and I've done a few other series that are very family-centered, I'm recreating the world that I kind of wish I'd had in terms of, you know, I think I broke my parents' heart at one point because I, you know, referred to myself instead of an only child as a lonely child. And, you know, on the one hand, that was certainly true. But on the other, I was then surrounded and made the attempt to surround myself with lots of friends who also became family.
Mm-hmm.
So that I've lived both sides of that. You know, one is my fantasy, the family-oriented books, the big, extended, crazy, dysfunctional-type families like the O'Briens, and all the dynamics that come with people who love each other dearly, don't always get along, try to work out their differences, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, which is very much my life, where you have strong bonds with your friends. I mean, in
mm-hmm.
the end,
mm-hmm.
in the books that I've written, they tend to be women friends. But in my life, I've got both women friends and male friends that have been in my life for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was born, my birthday puts me like on the cusp between a Cancer and a Leo. And one of the traits, I don't follow astrology that closely, but one of the traits of Cancerians, as I understand it, is we tend to hang on to things and people. And so the people who've been my friends, I mean, my best friends from when I was a kid are still among my best friends. And, you know, my best friends from college are still among my best friends. And
mm-hmm.
even among the men that I've dated, some of them are still some among my best friends. There are a few, not so much.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
And so I think those things are so important because in both cases, family, certainly you have the bonds of an entire history that goes together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you remember things about your grandparents, your aunts, your uncles, and so every time you're together, there's all of this shared identity that comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same thing is true with friends who've been in your life a very long time. They, too, have an important part of your history
mm-hmm.
that they keep centered and keep
mm-hmm.
you centered on that. And you know, I was saying this to somebody just the other day that particularly when, thanks to Facebook and places like that where people are reuniting with people they used to know, that you come back together now with who you are now. And that although, you know, the history is important,
right,
you're relating in a different way when you come back together now.
Right.
And you know, I think that that's one of the things that's very interesting about social networking is how it's enabled us to find those people who maybe were once and all that kind of thing, and
mm-hmm.
to try to pull that all back together and
mm-hmm.
you know, reestablish those ties.
Well, your novel is set in a small town on the eastern seacoast, and small town books, especially like yours, seems to be very popular with readers. What do you think is the driving trend for this?
Well, I've had a theory. I mean, I was doing this kind of book a long time ago, and
mm-hmm.
I think I started actually trying to analyze it maybe 8 years ago or so. Anyway, not a while back.
Yeah.
And I believe that these days, I mean, at one time in society, families continued to live in the same small town or maybe moved to the next town over. They were
mm-hmm.
close by. And
mm-hmm.
now I think families are so spread out. They are, you know, sometimes live far across the country. They maybe only get together once a year, if that. They communicate by email. They communicate by phone. But I think that for many of us, we idealize the idea of that small town where everybody knows you, where you've got that sense of history, where people support each other, and where the town in many ways then kind of replaces your family. And for those of us who are scattered, reading about that reinforces
mm-hmm.
that need in us. and tells us that, you know, no matter, even if our family's far away, you can create your own family within that world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that one of the things that makes the kind of books that I write and Debbie Maycomer writes and Susan Wiggs, and there, I mean, there are a lot of authors who do this kind of thing, who create worlds that readers can go back to. I think it's even true, frankly, in mystery novels,
mm-hmm.
where it's a series. I think one of the reasons that certain books, whether it's Sue Grafton's books or Sarah Paretsky's books or any of the many other mystery series that people have read over the years, they like to go back to a character they've come to know. It becomes a friend.
Right.
And the community that they're in becomes a place they like to visit again. And I think that that fulfills a real need for us in the world we live in today.
How significant it is for your setting, because I know you live in a small town from that perspective.
Right.
So do you collect all that sort of the ambiance of where you live and put everything into the book?
That always becomes interesting because I have to be very careful about which parts of my books I collected from my neighborhood.
Yeah.
But absolutely, absolutely. That's the thing. You know, I mean, the town where I spend my summers was the town that I spent my summers in as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the friends that I had as a kid are still there. Some are there full-time, some are there still just part-time. But they're
mm-hmm.
still around. And that whole small-town atmosphere of knowing what everybody else is doing and
mm-hmm.
all those kinds of things absolutely ends up in my books. And I have mm-hmm. to say, you know, I think that I and other writers probably idealize it a bit. You know, it's not all
right.
Perky and wonderful as it comes across in the books. It can be exasperating and annoying and crazy. But I think, again, and that goes back to sort of borrowing from your own life when you create these books.
Mm-hmm.
In my little town, we had political battles a number of years ago about the development of our boardwalk area.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something I was very, very passionate about because I remembered the olden days and the way the boardwalk had been in the olden days and everything, and they wanted to put condos on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very ardent in my battling about not doing that. And I had a small bookstore in town at the time, and I knew when I took that stand, because
mm-hmm.
it was very divisive in this little town,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing more divisive than politics in a little town. And I knew there would be people who would not set foot in my store again because of it. And I, you know, it was just something I cared so much about and thought was so important to the future of the town. And, you know, and then I happened to be writing a series of also in a small beach town, but in Virginia instead of Maryland at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of those books, I got to develop the boardwalk my way.
Mm-hmm. You created your own
boardwalk. You know, and I was not necessarily right. terribly popular with some of the people mm-hmm. in town over that. You know,
yeah.
and then on the other
yeah.
hand, others were saying, oh, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what should happen. But I had to be very careful because I would describe characters and they would say, oh, my gosh, that sounds really too familiar.
Very interesting. Tell us about Chesapeake Shores Christmas, the inspiration behind it and the story that you put together, because this is the fourth in its series. So
right.
it's quite special. It's a special edition for the holiday season. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the characters of Mick O'Brien, the father in the three books, and Megan O'Brien, was sort of begging to be told. This is a couple who are in their 50s and had divorced, and very bitterly, in fact. She had left, and it was an all-too-typical story of a husband who was very ambitious, you know, driving to accomplish major things. He's an urban designer, an architect, and he had actually designed the community of Chesapeake Shores. And that became such a forerunner for sort of the designed community that he was in, called to work all over the world and everything, and had neglected his family with these five kids. And so she had actually taken off to try to make a point to him about, you know, she was not going to stay home and be if she was going to be a single mother, she wasn't going to do it with him. She was going to go be a single mother. And when she left, it created terrible, as you can imagine, repercussions for these five children, the youngest of whom was only about seven at the time. And so in the course of the first three books, we begin to see the effect that that had on the children, and the mom actually comes back to town. One of the children is determined to try to reunite the family and bring the mother back in, at least on the periphery, so that, you know, fences are being mended. And in the course of doing that, the fences are also mended between Mick and Megan. And in A Chesapeake Shores Christmas, not only are they reunited, but the one son who's the strongest holdout and who has built his entire life around animosity towards his mother and the impact that the divorce had, and he became a divorce attorney, and he always wants to handle the guy side because he hated his mother so much for this. So it really is a bit of a reunification or a reconciliation between mother and son, because she doesn't want to have the wedding until he's on board.
Right.
And I think it's very interesting, and I've had some dialogues with some readers, you know, of, would you do this? Would you put your life on hold because one child, particularly an adult child, says no, you know, and he's just adamantly opposed to it. He is just, and she doesn't want to do it. And then some other pieces come into play that begin to fall into place, and of course this is in fact a romance, so we do live happily ever after, but it's the holiday season with all of the complexities you can imagine, and you throw a wedding into the mix. And I think that you know, it's a story that a lot of readers were waiting for after I did the first three books, and you know, I've had very, very nice responses to it. People who didn't like Megan originally because they just couldn't understand how she could go off and leave these children.
Right.
And I think they've come to understand that she never meant to leave them. They were supposed to come to New York, and then she tried to do the right thing by letting them stay in their home, and yet they hated her for it. And she's slowly but surely showing them that, I mean, you know, she had rooms for them. She had bits and pieces of their life. She had photograph albums. And they're realizing that their perceptions are not the total reality. I think, you know, there's a line, a famous quote from somebody or other that basically says, you know, there are three truths, yours, mine, and the truth.
Right.
And I think that's the case here, is that, you know, each of the children has their very valid perspective on how this all, how the marriage existed, how it fell apart, what she did to them. She has her perspective, and then somewhere in the middle is the reality of what actually happened and why it happened and everything. And for a little short Christmas card story, I mean, I think it has a little bit of meat to it. It's not all happiness and light, but I think it works. And of course, it sets up Connor's story, which is coming up next.
What I like about it is that it is a wonderful snapshot of real life, real situation in some way. So you were able to bring in the essence of this situation and love and fear, which goes hand in hand in real life, real situation. And then to top it off, of course, it's focused on the holiday season, which everyone knows how stressful life could be during this time of the year. So, yes, wonderfully laced with all these real-life situations. So I think it has its own natural feeling that people can really connect, because holiday season is when it brings all kinds of feeling up, the good, bad, and ugly.
Well, and don't you think, too, that in every family, and it goes back to me and my talking about the fantasy kind of thing that we all have about what the holidays ought to be.
Right.
And then the reality of what they often are, in that, you know, all of the stressors that we kind of think are behind us suddenly come out again when you're all put in the same room. And people are, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, Uncle Joe gets drunk or, you know, Uncle Sue brings the worst gifts in captivity. All of those pieces then come in, and you've got strain and you've got stress, and you go home afterwards just thinking, oh my goodness, I'm so glad it's over with. And and I don't know whether that's because, and you may have some good ideas about this, as to whether or not that's, you know, we just build our expectations too high, whether we're just not able to achieve the peace and harmony that the season is supposed to be about, if that, you know, if human beings are not capable of that. And sometimes I think the reality is we are much better at capturing that, the spirit of the season, with strangers. You know, I mean, I'm real nice to store clerks this time of year. And not necessarily to people I, you know, that I should be nicer to.
Well, what happens is that we have all the archives, so to speak, and so we tend to remember the negatives more than the positives. Unfortunately, that's in our DNA. But I think in the end, if we allow our love to exceed our fear, then we will experience harmony in everything we do, and especially during the holiday season.
Right, right. Well, and but how do you get to that stage?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you sort of let go? And I think this is true not just at the holidays, but all the time.
Right,
and
right.
I have this conversation with a friend of mine who's a minister, because he, you know, says I'm notorious for holding a grudge. I mean, it takes a long time for me to lose my temper, but once I have, heaven forbid,
right.
You know. And I think that learning forgiveness in general, and
mm-hmm.
learning to let it be,
mm-hmm.
and is very difficult.
In your case, how about the Woods family? What do you do to keep stress levels down during the Christmas season?
Well, I think that I tend to start Christmas very early, and it comes
mm-hmm.
from the days, well, it comes in part from having so many people in my family scattered and friends scattered, and so much of my stuff has to be shipped. And in order to do presents and get all of those things done, I tend to start early, and I mean, I've been finished for like 3 weeks. Everything.
Good for you.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's disgusting. But you know, it's like 2 weeks ago, I had this mound on my treadmill, which is, of course, the perfect spot for things, because heaven forbid it get used for its normal purpose. But, you know, I piled high with all of these presents, and everything was wrapped and ready to go. And then 2 days later, it was all out the door. And
mm-hmm.
so on the one hand, you know, because I love to do the wrapping, I love to do the shopping. Although one of my friends pointed out to me that I am not a shopper, I'm a buyer.
Mm-hmm.
I go out, I have a mission, I know who's getting presents today, and those are the ones I go for, and I'm back home in 2 hours. And other people, you know, can go, I don't know how they do it. They wander through a store until something strikes their fancy. That would make me insane. But so everything then is sort of gone and organized, and I now have the putting up of my tree down to a science. It gets done during commercials and football games.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they have sometimes really long commercials in football games that I can get a lot done. You know, it's like I rush over and hang three ornaments and sit back down again. So I get it done early, and that does relieve a lot of the stress. Now, I will say that in terms of my family dynamics, I mean, my parents are both gone.
Mm-hmm.
I have one 97-year-old aunt still alive on my dad's side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my cousins. And there were a lot of stressors trying to bring that little unity together, that little unit back into play. And now my way of handling that is I stay in Florida. Do you recommend that? Is that a good way to go?
There you go. Leave me alone.
That's right. I mean, I have a Christmas circle down here that is we're very convivial. but you know, if I go up there, I start having heart attacks over stupid
mm-hmm.
stuff. I mean, it just makes me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say that's not necessarily the best way to handle the holiday situation, is to avoid it completely. Now, when my dad was alive, you know, up until he died, I was there at Christmas time, and we were stressed, and
mm-hmm.
and everybody was trying to figure out who was fixing what and when and where, and, you know, why didn't somebody actually call with the right invitation and all those kinds of things. And so, I mean, it was we were just pretty much a normal family in terms of the battling and all that kind of thing. Now, I have a goddaughter who lives in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and her entire extended family, and we've all been very close. The parents
mm-hmm.
were in college with me, and when my goddaughter turned 30, though, I looked at her and I said, "You and your husband are now my friends. I have no idea who your parents are, because I can't possibly be old enough to have a goddaughter who's 30." But you know, now there are a lot of kids, and we spend summers together in the Outer
mm-hmm.
Banks. There are like 16 of us that get together, and that was going to be very interesting for me, the first year we did that, because I'm used to being on my own and writing, and my company, when I have company, is for, you know, 3 days, maybe a week,
mm-hmm.
and it's not in large quantity. And so here we are going to the Outer Banks to this house with 16 mm-hmm. people, you know, many mm-hmm. of them little. And I'm thinking to myself, am I going to get through this without losing my mind? And it was
right.
wonderful. I mean, I had the best time. And, you know, so we're already scheduled for our third year of doing this. And we added a new baby last summer, so that got a little livelier. And, mm-hmm. maybe it's because it's not my daily life that mm-hmm. I have mm-hmm. been able to sort of walk in the door and say life will not be the same for the next week.
Right.
And just take it for whatever it was. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure I could do that if I were related to these people. Maybe it's because I'm not technically related and I could disown them that I'm able to,
there you
to be
go.
So calm. That's
and I'll good. Do you a favor. I'll bleep that part out, you know.
Yeah.
So that they said, what's that, Grandma? You know, I didn't exactly hear that.
Oh, dear.
Technical difficulties.
Yes, exactly, exactly. The missing minutes on the Nixon tape
there
were probably right about family dynamics or something.
What are the future books that is going to complement Chesapeake Shores series? I know you mentioned one, so let's talk
right.
a little bit about that to kind of give us the idea of where Chesapeake series is going to be heading to.
The three books in the Chesapeake Shores series this spring, they're coming out in April, May, and June.
Mm-hmm.
And the first book, Driftwood Cottage, focuses on Connor, who was the youngest of the boys in the family, and the attorney who is so opposed to his parents remarrying. And the beginnings of his story are sort of hinted at, well, more than hinted at, in the Chesapeake Shores Christmas. The woman in his life, who he is very committed to but refused to marry because, as far as he's concerned, marriage is a piece of paper that obviously meant nothing to his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sees no reason to get married, and yet he's very committed to this woman. He's very much in love with this woman. And
mm-hmm.
they have a child, and when they have the child, that's not enough for her anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so the course of their story at Driftwood Cottage is him waking up to the fact that it's more than that marriage is more than a piece of paper, and that his love for this woman is worth taking that leap of faith to make a really true commitment
mm-hmm.
to the rest of their lives, and mm-hmm. and her willingness to believe that, you know, his epiphany is genuine
mm-hmm.
because she's seen him in action, and he makes major changes in his life and in his career. He goes from being a divorce attorney to moving back to Chesapeake Shores and becoming a small town attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And his mentor in the town, I think, is very important because, you know, he's not on scene very much, but his comments to him are that as a divorce attorney, he was seeing people only at their absolute worst,
mm-hmm.
at the time in their lives when they're bitter and unhappy and angry and all of that kind of thing. And that working as an attorney in a small town, he was going to see them at all stages. He was going to
mm-hmm.
see them when he was helping them with a real estate transaction and how happy they were in their new home. And he
mm-hmm.
was going to see them, you know, at all these different occasions. And they were going to be his friends and his neighbors. And so he'd have a more rounded picture
mm-hmm.
of what people were really like instead of this one little negative microscopic
right.
portion of their lives.
Right.
And, you know, so I think that from that standpoint, that book is fairly interesting. And then the next book is Moonlight Cove. And Jess O'Brien, who is the daughter who runs the inn at Eagle Point from the first
mm-hmm.
book, and has attention deficit disorder. And everybody's been sort of waiting to see who she's going to end up with. And, of course, and it ends up being Will Lincoln, a psychologist, and she is very opposed to even dating him because she spent her whole life feeling that she was different because of having ADD,
mm-hmm.
and she's afraid he's just analyzing her all the time. And it takes a while for them to work through that, you know, that's not what he sees
mm-hmm.
when he looks at her. And he actually comments to her at one point, you know, we all have our flaws, yours just have a name.
Mm-hmm.
And makes her realize that, you know, that she's an entirely different whole person, of which ADD is only one aspect of what she is. And that, you know, he understands not only who she is on that level, but on all these other levels as well. And then the third story, called Beach Lane, which comes out in June, is a story that is one of the cousins, Susie O'Brien. And for several of the books now, she and a character named Mac have been, quote-unquote, not dating. Mm-hmm. They've been spending all their time together, but she won't date anybody like him because he's been a real player and everything, you know, chasing all these women and everything, and she just wants no part of that. And so here they've spent all this time together, and it's gotten to be a cliche in the family and a joke that they're not dating. And then she has a health crisis. And this ultimate player proves to her at the very, you know, very early on that he's got exactly what it takes to stay there with her and to be with her through all of this, and that no matter what, you know, he is there. And you know, it's sort of his discovery of what he's worth. And he's got an interesting background in terms of the way he grew up and his attempts to prove himself in many ways, and now when it really counts, he proves himself in the best possible way. So, and then there will actually be another Christmas story next fall in the O'Brien family with one of Susie's brothers. So, you know, this family, I mean, it's fairly finite. There will also be other brother will have a story in the spring, and there's secondary storylines in here with some of the other family members and, and so on that go through these stories as well. But I've had such a good time with them, and you know, I think that, that Luke's story will probably wrap it up in 2012. But you never know. I have a habit of thinking I'm finished, and then somebody pops up and demands to have something written about them. So you never know.
Fantastic. Where can someone buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, in terms of keeping up with what's coming out and so on, and I have to say I'm not as speedy about getting all the new stuff up. I get it up ahead of time, but it's not always quite as fast as I would like. But I have a website, CherylWoods.com, and so the information is always there. And then I have a blog that's tied into that website, which I tend to write about other things, but has some book information. And I'm on Facebook. They can be a friend on Facebook. And I do pop on there and occasionally have little contests and things like that on Facebook. That's my was my first venture and probably will be my only venture into social networking because trying to keep up is crazy. But it's been really fascinating to me to see how that all works and everything. And as far as where they can buy the books, they're available everywhere. They're available in Walmart and Target and Barnes & Noble Borders, some grocery stores, drug stores, and the publisher is doing an amazing job right now of bringing out some of my backlist so people have been able to start catching up with books they missed earlier on. And, and in fact, I think just next week, a book called The Backup Plan, which was the first book in my Charleston trilogy, is being reissued, and it will be back in stores next week. And it's been unavailable for quite a while, and people have been clamoring to get it because the third book in that trilogy was still available, and so they would read that and realize there were two before it. So we're trying to get those two books out this year, and The Backup Plan will be out as of next Tuesday, I believe.
Great. Coming back to your blog, you have an interactive blog called Just Between Friends.
Right.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that. What can people get out of reading your blog?
Well, it's a I wasn't real sure whether I had enough to say to do a blog, and I'm still frequently not sure that I have enough to say to do a blog. I didn't want to write a blog about writing, which is not to say that occasionally I don't go in there and talk about either a specific book or something related to one of my books. But generally speaking, what I've tried to do in the blog is to hit on topics that women are talking about and in the sort of context of Just Between Friends. And I'm, you know, confiding my reactions. And, in fact, the most recent one, which I did yesterday, is about getting ready for Christmas and you know, trying to pull it together ahead of time and all this kind of thing. And then I did one a couple weeks ago about I thought I should be on Dancing with the Stars because I would be, like, the best underdog of all times. And so So, you know, because that was at the time when there was a hot topic about Dancing
right.
with the Stars going on. And so sometimes it's very serious. I did one about the state of hunger in America and compared that to some of the battles going on over these cupcake wars, so-called,
mm-hmm.
in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes, I mean, you know, I pay attention to the news and something will strike me and I, you know, I go on there and it gives me a chance to kind of rant about it. And, you know, I would love to have people comment more. And it's been interesting because I tease to it often on Facebook and
mm-hmm.
people come back and comment on Facebook. I think that's easier sometimes than clicking on the blog
mm-hmm.
and, you know, creating their own. I mean, I know for me, creating 15 million passwords and then actually remembering them. So, you know, I think my password on some particular site not long ago was "This is stupid,"
mm-hmm.
which I am very good about actually remembering that password, but now I can't remember what it goes to. But, you know, I mean, I have friends who diligently keep the same password for everything, but I think, oh, that's probably bad, so I create
right.
all these others, and then I don't remember any of them. But at any rate, I do think that, you know, I'd love to have people come in. And I've had guest bloggers come in, and I may try
mm-hmm.
to do that some more and have people come on. And I've had the opportunity recently to get an advance peek at some books by a couple of authors that I really love. And so I'm hoping as the pub dates for those books come out,
mm-hmm.
I'll either have them guest blog or I'll write some more about their books on
mm-hmm.
on my blog. So I think it tends to be more personal
mm-hmm.
than it is publishing-oriented.
Right.
And, you know, people can come on and they can agree with me or disagree with me. And, I mean, I love to have the feedback and the interaction. And, you know, my only thing is if they want to come on and rip my books apart, they do it kindly. I would prefer kindly would be nice.
There you go. I understand that. How has being a successful author impacted you personally?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I like to think that I am still the same person, and I think I'm still so flabbergasted,
mm-hmm.
and I'm still kind of in awe. I mean, if a book actually hits a bestsellers list, I just sort of am like waiting and with my breath held while the lists are coming out to see if each book is going to be on there and where it's going to be, and I worry about it and I fret about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made my life easier in some ways, certainly. I mean, because if the books are selling well, you make more money than I ever dreamed I could possibly make doing this
mm-hmm.
compared to what I was, you know, getting like $4,000 for those first books or whatever. I mean, this has been very good, and I've been very fortunate to be able to create a schedule
mm-hmm.
that is very accommodating to also having a life,
mm-hmm.
at least
mm-hmm.
for me. I mean, my writing schedule is such that I work very hard in the morning. I spend the afternoons doing PR-related things, or I can go out and do things with my friends if I choose to.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's certainly many stressors that go with it, too. But on balance, I certainly can't say that this has been any kind of inconvenience in my life. It's been pretty astonishing. I mean, it, when I sit back and look, or I look every now and then when I'm updating the checklist
mm-hmm.
on my website of various books. And that's one thing on the website that I highly recommend, if they haven't done it, that readers take a look at. Because on that checklist, all of my 100-and-some books have been grouped by series.
Mm-hmm.
So that if, you know, they pick a book up in a used bookstore or in a regular bookstore somewhere, and they're not sure how it fits in, they can go right on there and they can see where it fits within
mm-hmm.
a particular series and what the other books are and that kind of thing. But I look at that and I'm thinking to myself, was there ever that much in my brain? I mean, how did that happen? It really is kind of astounding. And, you know, I'll get emails from people and they'll mention it invariably mm. character names, you know, from some book in the past that they picked up,
right.
you know, at a flea market or something. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, who the heck were those people? And what story was that? And I'm trying to put the pieces together because after a while, you start running out of names. I had a reader a couple of years ago who wrote me a very scathing letter because she said
mm-hmm.
that I had used the name of some author in vain, you know, that
mm-hmm.
she thought she didn't like the character, in other words,
mm-hmm.
that I created, and it had nothing to do with that author because I didn't even realize it was an author.
Right.
You know, I'm just plucking names out of thin air and,
precisely,
you know,
yeah,
names that seem to go together. And it'd be interesting at some point. I'm not going to be the one who does it, but it would be very interesting to sit down and make lists of all the names of all the characters in all my books, mm-hmm, just to see how many names I've had, how many people I've had. I mean, most people have to name five kids at the most. You know, I've named hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids.
There you go. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Well, I think my recipe for living, and I sort of got this, I mean, I was already living it, but mm-hmm, I sort of got it solidified by a 99-year-old friend of my mom's who absolutely believed that a sense of humor was the most important thing in aging well.
Mm-hmm.
And she told a wonderful story about going out one day, and she was going to bring in her garbage can, and it was one of the great big ones on wheels, and she was very tiny and petite.
Mm-hmm.
And she tilted it over to look in it to see if it was clean, because mm-hmm, her neighbor didn't keep her garbage can nearly as clean as she did. And so she tilted it over, and when she tilted it over to look in it, she fell in head first.
Oh, my God.
And so there she is, lying on the side of the street, inside a garbage can, you know, with her little feet kicking,
right,
up and down, until some guy finally drove by and, you know, tapped on the mm-hmm side of the can and said, could you use some help?
Yeah.
And she was told that story, and, you know, she's just mm-hmm laughing hysterically at herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important for all of us never, I don't care who you are or what position you're, not to take ourselves too seriously.
Right.
And to be able to look at the world with a sense of humor and laughter. I mean, I think there are all sorts of studies about how important laughter is
mm-hmm
to health. And mm-hmm, and I believe that. I really do. I think that if there's a recipe in my life, it's mm-hmm to find as many things as I can to laugh about and not take myself too seriously.
That's fantastic. Cheryl, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. And to all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me in a couple of weeks in the new year on Tuesday morning, January the 4th. My guest will be Linda Berry, the owner of Spiritual Discovery Center. As a professional practicing astrologer, Linda specializes in modern Western astrology as well as spiritual astrology. Linda and I will be discussing about her life's journey, the recent lunar eclipse, and the solar eclipse, which will occur on the day of our show on January the 4th. She will also do mini cosmic readings for interested listeners. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Merry Christmas and a very happy New Year and peace on earth to everyone. Cheryl, thank you again. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you and your family.
Same to you. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.